Chapter 6. When I returned to General Carr's command after my experience as a prisoner, I was informed that the general had been waiting for me for 2 weeks. "I'm glad you've come, Bill," said the general. "While we've been at this post, a number of valuable animals have been stolen, as well as many government horses and mules. We think the thieves are still near the fort. Fresh tracks have been found near Fort Lyon. Perhaps Bill Green, the scout, who has been up there, can tell you something about them." Sending for Green, I found that he had marked the place where he had lost the trail of the marauders. Next morning, accompanied by Green, Jack Farley, and another scout, I set out after the horse thieves. While making a circuit about the tracks we had found leading away from the spot where Green discovered them, we found the trail of 12 animals, 4 mules and 8 horses, in the edge of the sandhills. From this point we had no trouble in trailing them down to the Arkansas River. This stream they had followed toward Denver, whither they were undoubtedly bound. When we got within 4 miles of Denver, we found that the thieves had passed 4 days before. I concluded that they had decided to dispose of the animals in Denver. I was aware that Saturday was the big auction day there, so we went to a hotel outside the town to await the day. I was too well known in the city to show myself there, for the thieves would have taken alarm had they learned of my presence. Early Saturday morning we rode into the city, and stabled our animals at the Elephant Corral. I secured a room in a hotel overlooking the corral, and took up a post of observation. I did not have to wait long. A man, whom I recognized at once as Williams, one of our old packers, rode into the ring, mounted on Lieutenant Forbush's mule, and leading another government mule. This mule had been recently branded, and over the U.S. a plain DB had been stamped. As the man's confederate did not appear, I decided he was outside with the rest of the stolen animals. When Mr. Forbush's mule was put up at auction, I came down to the corral and walked through the crowd of bidders. The packer saw me, and tried to get away, but I seized him firmly by the shoulder. "I guess, my friend," said I, "that you'll have to go with me. Make any resistance and I'll shoot you on the spot." To the auctioneer and an inquisitive officer I showed my commission as a United States detective. With Farley and Green, who were close at hand, I took my prisoner 3 miles down the Platte. There we dismounted, and began preparations to hang our prisoner to a limb. We informed him that he could escape this fate only by telling us where his partner was hidden. He at first denied having any partner, but when we gave him 5 minutes to live unless he told the truth, he said his pal was in an unoccupied house 3 miles farther down the river. We took up our journey, and, coming in sight of the house, saw a number of animals grazing near it. As we rode to the door, another of our old packers, whom I recognized as Bill Bevins, stepped to the front door. I instantly covered him with my rifle, and ordered him to throw up his hands, before he could draw his revolver. Looking through the house, we found saddles, pack saddles, lariats, blankets, overcoats, and 2 Henry rifles. We returned with the whole outfit to Denver, where we lodged Williams and Bevins in jail. The next day we tied each man to a mule and started on the return journey. At the hotel, where we had stopped before making the arrests, we were joined by our man with the pack mule. That night we camped on Cherry Creek, 17 miles from Denver. It was April, and the weather was cold and stormy. We found a warm and cozy camping place in the bend of the creek. We made our beds in a row, feet to the fire. The prisoners had thus far been docile, and I did not think it necessary to hobble them. They slept inside, and it was arranged that someone was to be constantly on guard. About 1 o'clock in the morning it began snowing. Shortly before 3, Jack Farley, who was on guard, and sitting at the foot of the bed with his back to the prisoners, was kicked into the fire by Williams. The next instant Bevins, who had got hold of his shoes, sprang up, jumped over the fire, and started away on the run. As soon as I was enough awake to comprehend what was going on, I sent a shot after him. Williams attempted to follow Bevins, but as he did so I knocked him down with the butt of my revolver. Farley had by this time got out of the fire. Green had started after Bevins, firing at him as he ran, but the thief made his escape into the brush. In his flight, unfortunately for him, he dropped one of his shoes. Leaving Williams in charge of Farley and Long Doc, the man with the pack mule, Green and I struck out for Bevins. We heard him breaking through the brush, but, knowing it would be useless to try to follow him on foot, we went back and saddled two of the fastest horses. At daylight we struck out on his trail, which was plainly visible in the snow. Though he had an hour and a half start, his track lay through a country covered with prickly pear. We knew that with a bare foot he could make little progress. We could see, however, by the long jumps he was taking, that he was making excellent time. Soon the trail became spotted with blood, where the thorns of the prickly pear had pierced his shoeless foot. After a run of 12 miles we saw Bevins crossing a ridge 2 miles ahead. We reached the ridge just as he was descending the divide toward the South Platte, which at this point was very deep and swift. If he got across the stream he stood a good chance of escape. We pushed our horses as fast as possible, and when we got within range I told him to halt or I would shoot. He knew I was a good shot, and coolly sat down to wait for us. "Bevins, you gave us a good chase," I said, as we rode up. "Yes," he returned calmly, "and if I'd had 15 minutes more start, and got across the Platte you'd never have caught me." Bevins's flight was the most remarkable feat of its kind I have ever heard of. A man, who could run barefooted in the snow through a prickly pear patch was surely a tough one. When I looked at the man's bleeding foot I really felt sorry for him. He asked me for my knife, and when I gave it to him he dug the thorns out of his foot with its sharp point. I consider him the gamest man I ever met. I could not suffer a man with such a foot to walk, so I dismounted, and he rode my horse back to camp, while Green and I rode the other horse by turns. We kept a close watch on our prisoner. We had had plenty of proof that he needed it. His injured foot must have pained him fearfully, but never a word of complaint escaped him. After breakfasting we resumed our journey. We had no further trouble till we reached the Arkansas River, where we found a vacant cabin and took possession of it for the night. There was no fear that Bevins would try to escape. His foot was swollen to a great size, and was useless. Believing that Williams could not get away from the cabin, we unbound him. The cabin was comfortably warmed and well lighted by the fire. We left Long Doc on guard and went to sleep. At 1 o'clock Williams asked Doc to allow him to step to the door for a minute. Doc had his revolver in hand, and did not think it necessary to waken us. He granted the request. With Doc, revolver in hand, watching him, Williams walked to the outer edge of the floor. Suddenly he made a spring to the right, and was out of sight in the black darkness, before his guard could even raise his revolver. Doc leapt after him, firing just as he rounded the corner of the cabin. The report brought us all to our feet. I at once covered Bevins with my revolver, but, seeing that he could barely stir, I lowered it. Then in came Doc, swearing a blue streak and announcing that Williams had escaped. Nothing was left us but to gather our horses close to the cabin, and stand guard the rest of the night, to prevent the possibility of our late prisoner sneaking in and getting away with one of them. This was the last I ever saw or heard of Williams, but we got back to Fort Lyon with Bevins. Though we had lost one of our prisoners, General Carr complimented us on the success of our trip. The next day we took Bevins to Boggs Ranch, on Pickett Wire Creek, where he was to await trial. But he never was tried. He made his escape, as I had expected he would do. In 1872 I heard that he was at his old tricks on Laramie Plains. A little later he sent word to me, that if he ever met me he would kill me on sight. Shortly thereafter he was arrested and convicted for robbery, but made his escape from Laramie City Prison. Later he organized a desperate gang of outlaws, which infested the country north of the Union Pacific. When the stage began running between Cheyenne and Deadwood, these outlaws robbed coaches and passengers, often making big hauls of plunder. Finally most of the gang were caught, tried, and convicted, and sent to the penitentiary for a number of years. Bevins was among the number. Soon after my return to Fort Lyon, the 5th Cavalry was ordered to the Department of the Platte. While we were at Fort Wallace, getting supplies en route, I passed the quarters of General Bankhead, who had ordered my arrest on the occasion of my last visit to that post. The general sent out for me, and as I entered his office he extended his hand. "I hope you have no hard feelings for me, Cody," he said. "I have just had a talk with General Carr and Quartermaster Hayes. If you had told me you had permission to ride that horse and mule, there would have been no trouble." "That's all right, General," I said. "I don't believe your quartermaster's agent will ever circulate any more false stories about me." "No," said the general, "he hasn't recovered yet from the beating you gave him." When the command reached the North Fork of the Beaver, I rode down the valley toward the stream, and discovered a large fresh Indian trail. I found tracks scattered all over the valley and on both sides of the creek, as if a large village had recently passed that way. I estimated there could not be less than 400 lodges, or between 2,500 and 3,000 warriors, women, and children in the band. When I reported my discovery to General Carr, he halted his regiment, and, after consulting a few minutes, ordered me to select a ravine, or as low ground as possible, so that the troops might be kept out of sight of the Indians until we could strike the creek. We went into camp on the Beaver. The general ordered Lieutenant Ward to take 12 men and myself and follow up the trail for several miles. Our orders were to find out how fast the Indians were traveling. I soon made up my mind by the frequency of their camps that they were moving slowly, hunting as they journeyed. After we had scouted about 12 miles, keeping our horses well concealed under the bank of the creek, Ward and I left our horses and crept to a high knoll, where there was a good view for some distance downstream. As we looked over the summit of the hill, we saw a whole Indian village, not 3 miles away. Thousands of ponies were grazing on the prairie. To our left, on the opposite side of the creek, two or three parties of Indians were coming in, laden with buffalo meat. "This is no place for us, Lieutenant," said I. "I think we have business at the camp, which must be attended to as soon as possible." "I agree with you," he returned. "The quicker we get there, the better." We came down the hill, as fast as we could, and joined our men. Lieutenant Ward hurriedly wrote a note and sent it to General Carr by a corporal. As the man started away on a gallop, Ward said, "We will march slowly back until we meet the troops. I think General Carr will soon be here." A minute or two later, we heard shots in the direction taken by our courier. Presently he came flying back around the bend of the creek, with 3 or 4 Indians in hot pursuit. The lieutenant, with a squad of soldiers, charged upon them. They turned and ran across the stream. "This will not do," said Ward, when the last redskin had disappeared. "The whole village will know the soldiers are nearby." "Lieutenant," said I, "give me that note. I'll take it to the general." He gladly handed me the dispatch. Spurring my horse, I dashed up the creek. Soon I observed another party of Indians returning to the village with meat. I did not wait for them to attack me, but sent a shot after them at long range. In less than an hour I reached the camp and delivered the dispatch to General Carr. Boots and Saddles was sounded, and all the troops save 2 companies, which were left to guard the supply train, were soon galloping toward the Indian camp. When we had ridden 3 miles, we met Lieutenant Ward. He had run into a party of Indian hunters. One of their number had been killed in the encounter, and one of Ward's horses had been wounded. At the end of 5 miles we came in sight of hundreds of Indians, advancing up the creek to meet us. They formed a complete line on our front. General Carr, who wanted to strike their village, ordered the troops to charge, break through the line, and keep straight on. No doubt this movement would have been successfully executed had it not been for the daredevil, rattle-brained Lieutenant Sinoski, commanding Company B. Misunderstanding the orders, he charged on the Indians on the left, while the rest of the command swept through the line. The main body was keeping straight on toward the village, when it was discovered that Sinoski and his company were surrounded by 500 Indians. To save the company, General Carr was forced to order a halt and hurry back to the rescue. During the short fight, Sinoski had several men and a number of horses killed. Valuable time had been consumed by the rescue. Night was coming on. The Indians were fighting desperately to keep us from reaching their village, whose population, having been informed by courier of what was going on, was packing up and getting away. During the afternoon we had all we could do to hold our own with the mounted warriors. They stayed stubbornly in our front, contesting every inch of ground. The wagon train, which had been ordered to come up, had not arrived. Fearful that it had been surrounded, General Carr ordered the command to return and look for it. We found it at 9 o'clock that night, and went into camp. Next morning, when we moved down the creek, not an Indian was to be seen. Village and all, they had disappeared. 2 miles down the stream we came to a spot where the village had been located. Here we found many articles, which had been left in the hurry of flight. These we gathered up and burned. The trail, which we followed as rapidly as possible, led northeast toward the Republican River. On reaching that stream a halt was ordered. Next morning at daylight we again pulled out. We gained rapidly on the Indians, and could occasionally see them from a distance. About 11 o'clock that morning, while Major Babcock was ahead with his company, and as we were crossing a deep ravine, we were surprised by perhaps 300 warriors. They at once began a lively fire. Our men galloped out of the ravine to the rough prairie and returned it. We soon succeeded in driving the enemy before us. At one time we were so close upon them that they threw away most of their lodges and camp equipment and left their played-out horses behind them. For miles we could see Indian furniture strewn in all directions. Soon they scattered into small bodies, dividing the trail. At night our horses began to give out, and a halt was called. A company was detailed to collect all the loose Indian ponies, and to burn the abandoned camp equipment. We were now nearly out of rations. I was sent for supplies to the nearest supply point, Old Fort Kearney, 60 miles distant. Shortly after this the command reached Fort McPherson, which for some time thereafter continued to be the headquarters of the 5th Cavalry. We remained there for 10 days, fitting out for a new expedition. We were reinforced by 3 companies of the celebrated Pawnee Indian Scouts, commanded by Major Frank North. At General Carr's recommendation I was now made Chief of Scouts in the Department of the Platte, with better pay. I had not sought this position. I became a firm friend of Major North and his officers from the start. The Scouts had made a good reputation for themselves. They had performed brave and valuable services in fighting against the Sioux, whose bitter enemies they were. During our stay at Fort McPherson I made the acquaintance of Lieutenant George P. Belden, known as the White Chief. His life has been written by Colonel Brisbane, of the Army. Belden was a dashing rider and an excellent shot. An hour after our introduction he challenged me to a rifle match, which was at once arranged. We were to shoot 10 shots each at 200 yards for $50 a side. Belden was to use a Henry rifle. I was to shoot my old Lucretia. This match I won. Belden at once proposed another, 100-yard match, as I was shooting over his distance. This he won. We were now even, and we stopped right there. While we were at Fort McPherson, General Augur and Brevet Brigadier General Thomas Duncan, Colonel of the 5th Cavalry, paid us a visit for the purpose of reviewing our command. The men turned out in fine style, and showed themselves to be well-drilled soldiers. Next the Pawnee Scouts were reviewed. It was amusing to see them in their full uniform. They had been supplied with a regular cavalry uniform, but on this occasion some of them had heavy overcoats, others large black hats with all the brass accoutrements attached. Some were minus trousers and wore only breech clouts. Some had regulation pantaloons, but only shirts. Part of them had cut the breech of their pantaloons away, leaving only the leggings. Still others had big brass spurs, but wore no boots nor moccasins. But they understood the drill remarkably well for Indians. The commands were given them by Major North, who spoke their tongue as readily as any full-blooded Pawnee. They were well mounted, and felt proud of the fact that they were regular United States soldiers. That evening after the drill many ladies attended the dance of the Indians. Of all savages I have ever seen, the Pawnees are the most accomplishing dancers. Our command set out on the trail the next day. Shortly afterward, when we were encamped on the Republican River near the mouth of the Beaver, we heard the yells of Indians, followed by shots, in the vicinity of our mule herd, which had been driven down to water. Presently one of the herders, with an arrow still quivering in his flesh, came dashing into the camp. My horse was close at hand. Mounting him bareback, I galloped after the mule herd, which had been stampeded. I supposed that I would be the first man on the scene. But I found I was mistaken. The Pawnee scouts, unlike regular soldiers, had not waited for the formality of orders from their officers. Jumping their ponies bareback and putting ropes in the animals' mouths, they had hurried to the place from which the shots came and got there before I did. The marauders proved to be a party of 50 or more Sioux, who had endeavored to stampede our animals. They were painfully surprised to find their inveterate enemies, the Pawnees, coming toward them at full gallop. They had no idea the Pawnees were with the command. They knew that it would take regular soldiers a few minutes to turn out, and fancied they would have plenty of time to stampede the herd and get away. In a running fight of 15 or 20 miles, several of the Sioux were killed. I was mounted on an excellent horse Colonel Royal had selected for me. For the first mile or two I was in advance of the Pawnees. Soon a Pawnee shot past me. I could not help admiring the horse he was riding. I determined that if possible, the horse should be mine. He was a big buckskin, or yellow horse. I took a careful look at him, so as to recognize him when we got back to camp. After the chase was over I rode over to Major North, and asked him about the animal. I was told that he was one of the favorite steeds of the command. What chance is there to trade for him? I asked. It is a government horse, replied the major. The Indian who rides him is very much attached to him. I told Major North I had fallen in love with the horse, and asked if he had any objections to my trying to secure him. He replied that he had not. A few days later, after making the Indian several presents, I persuaded him to trade horses with me. In this way I became possessed of the buckskin, although he still remained government property. I named him Buckskin Joe, and he proved to be a second Brigham. I rode him during the summers of 69, 70, 71, and 72. He was the horse ridden by the Grand Duke Alexis on his buffalo hunt. In the winter of 72, after I had left Fort McPherson, Buckskin Joe was condemned and sold at public sale to Dave Perry at North Platte. In 1877 he presented him to me. He remained on my ranch on the Dismal River for many years, stone blind, until he died. At the end of 20 days, after a few unimportant running fights, we found ourselves back to the Republican River. Hitherto the Pawnee scouts had not taken much interest in me. But while at the camp I gained their respect and admiration by showing them how to kill buffaloes. Though they were excellent buffalo killers, for Indians, I had never seen them kill more than 4 or 5 animals in one run. A number of them would surround a herd and dash in on it, each one killing from 1 to 4 buffaloes. I had gone out in company with Major North, and watched them make a surround. 20 Pawnees, circling a herd, killed 32 buffaloes. As they were cutting up the animals, another herd appeared. The Pawnees were getting ready to surround it, when I asked Major North to keep them back, to let me show them what I could do. He did as I requested. I knew Buckskin Joe was a good buffalo horse, and, feeling confident that I would astonish the Indians, I galloped in among the herd. I did astonish them. In less than a half-mile run I dropped 36, killing a buffalo at nearly every shot. The dead animals were strung out over the prairie less than 50 feet apart. This manner of killing greatly pleased the Indians. They called me Big Chief, and thereafter I had a high place in their esteem. We soon left the camp and took a westward course up the Republican River. Major North, with 2 companies of his Pawnees, and Colonel Royal, with 2 or 3 companies of cavalry, made a scout north of the river. After making camp on the Blacktail Deer Fork, we observed a band of Indians coming over the prairie at full gallop, singing and yelling and waving their lances and long poles. We first supposed them to be the hostile Sioux, and for a few moments all was excitement. But the Pawnees, to our surprise, made no effort to go out to attack them. Presently they began singing themselves. Major North walked over to General Carr and said, "General, those are our men. They had had a fight. That is the way they act when they come back from battle with captured scalps. The Pawnees came into camp on the run. We soon learned that they had run across a party of Sioux, who were following a big Indian trail. The Sioux had evidently been in a fight. Two or three had been wounded, and were being carried by the others. The Pawnees jumped them, and killed three or four of their number. Next morning our command came up to the Indian trail, where the Sioux had been found. We followed it for several days. From the number of campfires we passed, we could see that we were gaining on the Sioux. Wherever they had camped, we found the print of a woman's shoe. This made us all the more eager to overtake them, for it was plain that they had a white woman as their captive. All the best horses were selected by the general, and orders were given for a forced march. The wagon train was to follow as rapidly as possible, while the command pushed on ahead. I was ordered to pick out five or six of the best Pawnees and proceed in advance of the command, keeping 10 or 12 miles ahead, so that when the Indians were overtaken we could learn the location of their camp, and give the troops the required information in time, to plan an effective attack. When we were 10 miles in advance of the regiment we began to move cautiously. We looked carefully over the summits of the hills before exposing ourselves to observation from the front. At last we made out the village, encamped in the sand hills south of the South Platte River at Summit Springs. Here I left the Pawnees to watch, while I rode back to the command and informed General Carr that the Indians were in sight. The men were immediately ordered to tighten their saddles and otherwise to prepare for action. I changed my horse for Old Buckskin Joe. He had been led for me up to this time, and was comparatively fresh. Acting on my suggestion, General Carr made a circuit to the north. I knew that if the Indians had scouts out they would naturally watch in the direction whence they had come. When we had passed the camp, and were between it and the river, we turned and started back. By this maneuver we avoided detection by the Sioux scouts. The general kept the command wholly out of sight until within a mile of the village. Then the advance guard was halted till all the soldiers caught up. Orders were issued that at the sound of the charge the whole command was to rush into the village. As we halted on the summit of the hill overlooking the still unsuspecting Sioux, General Carr called to his bugler, "Sound the charge." The bugler, in his excitement, forgot the notes of the call. Again the general ordered sound the charge. And again the musician was unable to obey the command. Quartermaster Hayes, who had obtained permission to join the command, comprehended the plight of the bugler. Rushing up to him, he seized the bugle, and sounded the call himself, in clear, distinct tones. As the troops rushed forward he threw the bugle away, and, drawing his pistol, was among the first to enter the village. The Indians had just driven up their horses, and were preparing to move camp, when they saw the soldiers. Many of them jumped on their ponies, and, leaving everything behind them, advanced to meet the attack. On second thought, however, they decided it would be useless to resist. Those who were mounted rode away, while those on foot fled for the neighboring hills. We charged through their village, shooting right and left at everything we saw. Pawnees, officers, and regular soldiers were all mixed together, while the Sioux went flying away in every direction. The general had instructed the soldiers to keep a sharp lookout for white women when they entered the village. Two were soon found. One of them was wounded, and the other had just been killed. Both were Swedes, and the survivor could not speak English. A Swedish soldier was soon found to act as interpreter. The woman's name was Weichel. She said that as soon as the Indian saw the troops coming, a squaw, the wife of Tall Bull, had killed Mrs. Alertus, her companion in captivity, with a hatchet. The infuriated squaw had attacked Mrs. Weichel, wounding her. The purpose of the squaw was apparently to prevent both women from telling the soldiers how cruelly they had been treated. The attack lasted but a little while. The Indians were driven several miles away. The soldiers gathered in the herd of Indian horses, which was running wild over the prairie, and drove the animals back into camp. After a survey of our work, we found we had killed about 140 Indians and captured 120 squaws and papooses, 200 lodges, and 800 horses and mules. General Carr ordered that all the teepees, lodges, buffalo robes, camp equipage, and provisions, including a large quantity of buffalo meat, should be gathered and burned. Mrs. Alertus, the murdered Swedish captive, was buried. Captain Kane read the burial service, as we had no chaplain with us. While this was going on, the Sioux warriors recovered from their panic and came back to give us battle. All around the attack of fight began. I was on the skirmish line and noticed an Indian who was riding a large bay horse and giving orders to his men in his own language. I could understand part of what he said. He was telling them that they had lost everything and were ruined, and was entreating them to follow him until they died. The horse this chief was riding was extremely fleet. I determined to capture him if possible, but I was afraid to fire at the rider lest I kill the horse. Often the Indian, as he rode around the skirmish line, passed the head of a ravine. It occurred to me that if I dismounted and crept up the ravine, I could, as he passed, easily drop him from the saddle with no fear of hitting the horse. Accordingly, I crept into the ravine and secreted myself there to wait till Mr. Chief came riding by. When he was not more than 30 yards away, I fired. The next instant he tumbled from the saddle, and the horse kept on his way without a rider. Instead of running back to the Indians, he galloped toward the soldiers, by one of whom he was caught. Lieutenant Mason, who had been very conspicuous in the fight, and had killed two or three Indians himself, came galloping up the ravine, and, jumping from his horse, secured the elaborate war bonnet from the head of the dead chief, together with all his other accoutrements. We both rejoined the soldiers. I started in search of the horse, and found him in the possession of Sergeant McGrath, who had captured him. McGrath knew that I had been trying to get the horse, and he had seen me kill its rider. He handed the animal over to me at once. I little thought at the time that I had captured the fastest running horse west of the Missouri River, but this later proved to be the fact. Late that evening our wagon train arrived. Mrs. Weichel, the wounded woman, had been carefully attended by the surgeons, and we placed her in the ambulance. Gathering up the prisoners, squaws, and papooses, we set out for the South Platte River, 8 miles distant, where we went into camp. Next morning, by order of General Carr, all the money found in the village was turned over to the adjutant. Above $2,000 was collected, and the entire amount was given to Mrs. Weichel. The command now proceeded to Fort Sedgwick, from which point the particulars of our fight, which took place Sunday, July 11, 1869, was telegraphed to all parts of the country. During our 2 weeks' stay at this post, General Augur, of the Department of the Platte, made us a visit, and complimented the command highly on the gallant service it had performed. Tall Bull and his Indians had long been a terror to the border settlements. For their crushing defeat, and the killing of the chief, General Carr and the command were complimented in general orders. Mrs. Weichel was cared for in the post hospital. After her recovery, she married the hospital's steward. Her former husband had been killed by the Indians. Our prisoners were sent to the Whetstone Agency, on the Missouri, where Spotted Tail and the friendly Sioux were then living. The captured horses and mules were distributed among the officers and soldiers. Among the animals which I thus obtained were my Tall Bull horse and a pony, which I called Powder Face. This animal figured afterward in the stories of Ned Bundline, and became famous. One day, while we were waiting at Fort McPherson, General Carr received a telegram announcing that the Indians had made a dash on the Union Pacific, killing several section men and running off stock of a fallen station. An expedition was going out of Fort McPherson to catch and punish the Redskins if possible. I was ordered by General Carr to accompany this expedition. That night I proceeded by rail to Fort McPherson Station, and from there rode horseback to the fort. Two companies, under command of Major Brown, had been ordered out. Next morning, as we were about to start, Major Brown said to me, "By the way, Cody, we're going to have a character with us on this scout. It's old Ned Bundline, the novelist. At the same time I saw a stoutly built man nearby who wore a blue military coat. On his breast were pinned perhaps 20 badges of secret societies and gold medals. He limped a little as he approached me, and I concluded that this must be the novelist. "He has a good mark to shoot at on his left breast," I said to Brown, "but he looks like a soldier." I was introduced to him by his real name, which was Colonel E.Z.C. Judson. "I was to deliver a temperance lecture tonight," said my new acquaintance, "but no lecture for me when there is a prospect of a fight. The major has offered me a horse, but I don't know how I shall stand the ride." I assured him that he would soon feel at home in the saddle, and we set out. The command headed for the North Platte, which had been swollen by mountain rains. In crossing we had to swim our horses. Budline was the first man across. We reached Au Fallon Station at 11 o'clock. In a short time I succeeded in finding an Indian trail. The party of Indians, which had come up from the south, seemed to be a small one. We followed the track of the Indians, to the North Platte, but they had a start of 2 days. Major Brown soon abandoned the pursuit, and returned to Fort Sedgwick. During this short scout, Budline had plied me with questions. He was anxious to go out on the next scout with me. By this time I had learned that my horse, Tall Bull, was a remarkably fast runner. Therefore, when Lieutenant Mason, who owned a racer, challenged me to a race, I immediately accepted. We were to run our horses a single dash of a half mile for $500 a side. Several of the officers, as well as Rube Wood, the post trader, offered to make side bets with me. I took them up until I had my last cent on Tall Bull. I saw from the start that it would be easy to beat the lieutenant's horse, and kept Tall Bull in check, so that no one might know how fast he really was. I won easily, and pocketed a snug sum. Everybody was now talking horse race. Major Brown said that if Tall Bull could beat the Pawnee's fast horse, I could break his whole command. The next day all the troops were paid off, including the Pawnees. For 2 or 3 days our Indian allies did nothing but run horses, as all the lately captured animals had to be tested to determine which was the swiftest. Finally the Pawnees offered to run their favorite against Tall Bull. They raised $300 to bet on their horse, and I covered the money. In addition I took numerous side bets. The race was a single dash of a mile. Tall Bull won without any trouble, and I was ahead on this race about $700. I also got up a race for my pony, Powder Face, against a fast pony belonging to Major Lute North, of the Pawnee Scouts. I selected a small boy living at the post for a jockey. Major North rode his own pony. The Pawnees, as usual, wanted to bet on their pony, but as I had not yet ascertained the running qualities of Powder Face I did not care to risk much on him. Had I known him, as well as I did afterward I would have backed him with every cent I had. He proved to be one of the swiftest ponies I ever saw, and had evidently been kept as a racer. The dash between the ponies was to be 400 yards. When I led Powder Face over the course he seemed to understand what he was there for. North was on his pony, my boy was up. I had all I could do to hold the fiery little fellow back. He was so lively on his feet, that I feared his young rider might not be able to stick on his back. At last the order to start was given by the judges. I brought Powder Face up to the score, and the word "go" was given. So swiftly did he jump away, that he left his rider sitting on the ground. Nevertheless he went through and won the race without a rider. It was an easy victory, and after that I could get no more races. General Carr having obtained a leave of absence, Colonel Royal was given command of an expedition that was ordered to go out after the Indians. In a few days we set out for the Republican, where, we had learned, there were plenty of Indians. At Frenchman's Fork we discovered a village, but did not surprise it, for the Indians had seen us approaching and were in retreat, as we reached their camping place. We chased them downstream and through the sand hills, but they made better time than we did, and the pursuit was abandoned. While we were in the sand hills, scouting the Niobrara country, the Pawnee Indians brought into camp some very large bones, one of which the surgeon of the expedition pronounced to be the thigh bone of a human being. The Indian said the bones were those of a race of people who long ago had lived in that country. They said these people were three times the size of a man of the present day, that they were so swift and strong that they could run by the side of a buffalo, and, taking the animal in one arm, could tear off a leg and eat it as they ran. These giants, said the Indians, denied the existence of a great spirit. When they heard the thunder or saw the lightning, they laughed and declared that they were greater than either. This so displeased the great spirit, that he caused a deluge. The water rose higher and higher till it drove these proud giants from the low grounds to the hills and thence to the mountains. At last even the mountain tops were submerged and the mammoth men were drowned. After the flood subsided, the great spirit came to the conclusion that he had made men too large and powerful. He therefore corrected his mistake by creating a race of the size and strength of the men of the present day. This is the reason, the Indians told us, that the man of modern times is small and not like the giants of old. The story has been handed down among the Pawnees for generations, but what is its origin no man can say.